I've been podcasting, talking about money stuff for well over 7 years now, and there are a couple of things that are certain. The first one is we always have new listeners who want to start investing for the first time, because you could be listening now and you've rocked up this podcast in the back of a debt ambulance on a stretcher. There's money everywhere, there's debt everywhere, and it's a crisis and we need to get you back financially healthy before you start investing. Or you've rocked up this podcast and you do have some cash and it's not a critical emergency and your financial situation is pretty good and you want to start investing. The other thing that's certain is one of the most popular topics that you want us to talk about is actually the investing itself. So whether you have been an investor for a long time and you want to still learn more or you still want to be encouraged, well, we're going to talk about investing for as long as we've got this microphone turned on. Now, today we are going to be covering some ETF stuff, some debt recycling, how to take action, because it can be hard to get started, but we can't do today's episode without the help of Sphere Home Loans. You know, mortgage brokers, they live and breathe mortgages every single day. So who better to work with to get the best mortgage for you? Remember, you can just search Sphere Home Loans or click the link in the show notes and they'll be happy to help wherever you are. And I just want to shout out Rachel Croon for joining us on the live property event tour. Rach came with us to Brisbane, to Sydney, to Melbourne, to Adelaide, and we had a lot of fun hitting the road and talking about all this stuff. So many of you who attended those workshops got so much out of them. And I just want to thank everyone for coming along to our live events and also for supporting what we do. My name's Glenn James. Today I'm joined by
Finn Scully.
And this is Money.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Vince Scully from Life Sherpa, thank you for joining me back on the microphone for an episode of Tim, This Is Money. So if you are an old hand around these streets, I'm just kind of rotating the guests out on a Tuesday just to provide as much contrast, variety, and all that fun stuff on each Tuesday. So last week we had Rebecca Pritchard, and actually we talked about one of your blog articles, which we'll touch on soon. But that's kind of what we're doing, everyone, just giving as much variety as possible. I'll be hosting different financial professionals and, of course, having some fun along the way. Now, Vince.
Glenn.
Haley put in the Facebook group, "Hi, just started to explore ETFs. I put a small amount into Vanguard. Do most of these companies essentially invest in the same shares? As I would like to have more than one ETF account. Can anyone shed some light on this for me? Thank you." So Haley has opened a Vanguard account, and I'm going to assume it is the Vanguard Diversified High Growth Fund, or it could be VAS. So what are we saying to Haley? She's just started to explore ETFs and she would like to have more than one ETF account. I mean, is it neat? Do you need more than one ETF?
Well, I guess the starting question is, why are you buying an ETF? Because an ETF is really just a container. So asking whether I should buy shares or ETFs or manage funds is a little like going into a bottle store and saying, should I buy bottles or cans before you've worked out what you want to drink? So if you're going on a hike, you probably want cans of beer. If you're sitting at home with candlelight and a Wagyu, you probably need a bottle of Shiraz, probably one with a cork. So the question is, what are you looking to buy? And starting with the canister is sort of the wrong place to start. Now, ETFs are a very useful way of buying lots of shares in one go, so I'm not dissing them in any way. But back to Haley's question, she says she's bought one. So the first question answer is, well, what does it invest in? So you could, for example, buy an Australian large company ETF, like the Vanguard Australian Share Fund or VAS, which is probably the biggest ETF in Australia. You could buy the Vanguard Bond Fund, which invests in Australian government bonds, called VAF. You could buy the Vanguard Real Estate Fund, VAP.
VAP.
So start with what you want to buy. And for most Australians in trying to build wealth, they'll be starting with an Australian share fund or a fully diversified fund. So Vanguard have a number of, as do other managers, nothing particularly special about Vanguard. So they've got a number of diversified funds which invest across Australian shares, international shares, and bonds. There's the Vanguard Diversified High Growth, or VDHG. There's the Vanguard Diversified Growth, or VDG, and right down to conservative.
I think we'll give Hayley some grace where, sure, what you said was technically correct about the bottle or the beer and the holder. If I just reread her question and said, instead of I've just started to explore ETFs, we're probably just going to read it as, hi, or I've just started to explore investing into the share market because everyone else is doing it.
Yeah, no, that's a fair call. And I wasn't having a go at
Of course,
Hayley, I just wanted to. But it's a good point that if I'm starting to explore investing, my first step is, why am I investing?
Yeah.
And if this is a long-term building wealth type investment, you probably want to be investing in growth assets. And that is assets like shares, real estate, infrastructure that can grow faster than inflation. And the first place most people start is with Australian shares because they're comfortable. You know, they're all brand names that we recognise. You know, you drive on a transurban road, you buy your gas from AGL, you shop at Coles, you bank at the CBA. So they're all familiar brand names that gives us comfort.
It's funny. I was in a Facebook group the other night from another podcast.
Oh, there are other podcasts.
They really are. And someone uploaded this ebook, right? They were flogging their own shat in there. And they're like, oh, if someone wants to get started in investing, this ebook is a good thing. And sure, it was a useful ebook, but way too over the top for someone who just wants to get started. And I typed my comment out. And then I'm like, oh, no, and I just delete it all. So, you know, I've just got to be a bit careful when I'm in other people's Facebook groups and typing comments. But my whole thing, I've kind of distilled it down because we've just finished this investing book. So this is top of mind to me. I reckon the first thing anyone should do, like Hayley, who wants to get started, is understand, number one, what a weighted index is. So we know if we put $1,000 into this weighted index, here's the exposure. And then get a brokerage app or a brokerage account or a platform. Who cares? There's millions of them. Go bloody Sharesies, go Superhero, go Perla, go Selfwealth. It doesn't actually matter. Pick one, throw $500 into IOZ, which is the top 200 ASX weighted index, VAS, which is the top 300 Australian shares. Put your own skin in the game, even if it's just $500 or $200 or whatever that is, and then start to learn. Look at the PDS because an ETF has a PDS, and just read it and start to understand with skin in the game. And I just really think really understanding what weighted indexes are will help so much. Start with a foundation of understanding and knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the early lessons are really around your behaviour. So often, am I allowed to mention brand names?
I just mentioned a million. So,
yeah, if you're starting off with $10, $20, $30, something like a raise with the roundups or whatever, it may not be the cheapest or the best, but the lesson you're going to learn very cheaply is, what do you feel when the market goes up and what do you feel when the market goes down? And that is the most important lesson you can learn. It doesn't really matter. It matters less at that point whether you're buying Australian shares or US shares.
Well, I think the reason why I didn't mention raise in my spray is because you can't rock up to raise and buy VAS. They've got their own portfolios.
And, you know, there's some lessons around asset allocations to be learned there. And, you know, if you've got $20, it's pretty hard to buy four ETFs or five ETFs. Mm. So it has the advantage that you start off with an experience of what a diversified portfolio looks like very cheaply, very low entry level, and you round up your spending. You have the app on your phone, so turn notifications on and learn how it feels when the market goes up and down. That's what you should be focused on right now. When you get to about 5,000, now's the time to start thinking about either buying into a professionally managed account like a StockSpot or a LifeSherpa Invest, or do you want to put the time and effort and engagement into managing your own? And for most people, that's more trouble than it's worth.
Mm.
And most people just can't be fagged. And life gets in the way, really. So, but the lessons you learn about your own behavior. So if the market goes up, do you feel like the next Warren Buffett? If it goes down, do you feel like hitting the sell button? Those lessons are worth their weight in gold.
And those lessons will be easier, particularly when there's downside, to make sure that you've got your personal spending plan under control.
Would that be the Glenn James spending
plan? It could be, Vincent. But Hayley, what I'm going to do, I'm going to jump on and comment on your post because I want to send you a copy of my book, Sort Your Money Out and Get Invested. And chapter 5 and 6 will go through everything I've talked about around a weighted index and diversified portfolios. But I think Vince and I both agree, superficial amounts of money in your world, you know, if you're worth $5 billion, well, 100 grand's superficial. You know, if you've got a regular income like most people and you want to get started, maybe it is under $500 to put in and to feel how things work.
Yeah.
You need skin in the game.
I mean, in many ways, the answer is get started.
Yeah.
And but when it starts becoming a material amount of money, like $5,000, now it matters what you're invested in. Up to that, it matters that you got started.
Totally. Okay, so we've covered, I guess, the beginner's vibe of getting started. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum, right? And let's talk about those who know what's happening. We've got significant wealth invested. We'll talk about them. And then we're going to talk about a third category, those who want to be started and want to be advanced but struggle to actually get started in the first place. Now, this whole thing around debt recycling, we see it a lot in Facebook groups and online. People talk about it. It is a legitimate financial strategy. So, Vince, I was wondering, can you maybe just explain how the debt recycling actually works practically? Can we use an example of someone may own a $1 million property and they've got a mortgage of $500,000?
Cool. And I think in going through this, it's important to differentiate between borrowing to invest and debt recycling. These two are not the same thing. They may appear like it from the outside, but when you look at what you're actually doing, it becomes a bit clearer. So debt recycling is for someone who has some debt that isn't eligible for a tax deduction. So that's usually your home. And so, you know, if you take your $1 million house, you've got a $500,000 debt and you've saved up $30,000 that you're ready to invest with. You could take that $30,000 and take it down to your Sharesies account or whatever your brokerage might be and buy some shares or some ETFs. Or you could take the $30,000, pay down your home loan by $30,000, redraw the $30,000 and invest that money in whatever shares you were going to buy. So you're not increasing your borrowing. You're simply washing your savings through your home loan and taking it back out again. And the effect of that is that the interest on that $30,000 is now tax deductible. And so if you're paying 6% on your home loan, 6% of $30,000 is $1,800 a year. And if you're a 39% taxpayer, you're going to get 39% of that back at tax time. So all you've done is turn $30,000 of non-tax deductible debt into $30,000 of tax deductible debt. And that's why it's called debt recycling.
Mm.
There's no new debt here and you're not borrowing to invest. All you're doing is shuffling your debt around. And so that has the net effect of increasing your return by the amount of this tax return. All other things being equal, you will generally get a 1 or 2% better return over time. The higher the interest rate, the better the deal works. The higher your tax rate, the better the deal works.
So what about, as an example, and we'll just keep it really practical, that $30,000, or let's use a bit more meat for the example. You've got $100,000 cash that you've saved or an inheritance.
Yep.
Okay. So you're like, oh, I've got this mortgage. I've had a $100,000 inheritance. There's no point if you've got a home loan or mortgage. Well, there's a psychology element, but I'll put in quotes, there's no point getting that $100,000 and saying, I'm going to buy shares with my inheritance.
That's
in that instance, mathematically, we pay down the home loan with $100,000, go knock on the mortgage broker's door and say, can I do a cash out of $100,000? They would set up a separate mortgage of $100,000 and then you invest that money.
Yep. So that's not a gearing strategy. You're not borrowing more money. And so quite often we get the question, well, if I'm paying 6% of my home loan and my diversified portfolio is going to make me 8.5% pre-tax, does that actually make any sense? And borrowing at 6% to invest at 8% does sort of make sense. But if the choice is earning 6% after tax by paying off your home loan or 8.5% pre-tax, that's a more marginal exercise. But those considerations don't come into account when you're looking at a pure debt recycling strategy, because that's, you've already made the invest decision.
Mm.
That is, I've got $100,000 I want to invest. And rather than taking that $100,000 and sticking it in my share brokerage account, I put it into my home loan first and then redraw it and put it into my brokerage account. And that's why it's called debt recycling.
And in practice, we would technically not redraw. We would set up a separate split for accounting purposes and all that.
Yeah, so you want to keep it clean and neat. It wants to be very clear that the money is going direct to
dividends,
your brokerage.
Or distributions from shares and or ETFs, you would pay them onto that mortgage or into your cash account to help fund the debt. Or you might decide.
But remember, there is no extra funding.
That's right.
You're still paying the same mortgage payment.
Yep. So what about the case of if we move to gearing? Because a lot of advisors out there would say, let's use a gearing strategy and use the dividends to pay down the debt, the non-deductible debt, and then we refinance and continue to rinse and repeat. So I guess what I'm saying, with that example, $500,000 mortgage, $1 million property, we've got another $300,000 of usable equity.
Yep.
Okay, so we'll go up to 80%. 80% is 800,000. 500 is the mortgage.
Yep.
We're going to borrow another 300,000, separate split. We're going to invest that 300,000 into the market, and the income that services that loan, you'd hope, can come out of your own income still.
Yep.
And any bonus out of dividends or distributions can pay down the home loan.
That's right. And
Extra repayments on the home
loan. But remember,
loan.
That is a decision to invest and a decision to borrow to invest. So completely different analysis. And the analysis there says, well, look, if I can borrow money at 6 and invest it at 8.5, that's probably a good deal as long as I can stay invested. And if you look at if you go back over the last 20 years, a diversified growth portfolio, it's probably delivered 8.5. Five of that is probably distributions.
Yeah.
And three and a half in capital growth. So if you're borrowing at 6 and you're getting 5 in dividends with a little bit of franking, you're probably washing your face.
Yeah. So the thing to remember, everyone, is when people do this, what they generally would do is, so example, we've borrowed our 300 grand, that split of the mortgage is tax deductible and it may be interest only.
Yep.
Then we're investing over here. And remember, it's got to be in your own name because that interest is claimed on your own tax return. Then the investment has to be in your own tax return.
Yep.
Then we're paying the dividends that we receive or the distributions we receive from the ETFs. And remember, sidebar, shares pay dividends, ETFs pay distributions. They would go onto the mortgage that's non-deductible. And we pay that down more, then in a year's time, we'll make a number up. We've got 50 grand of extra dividends. We've had a cracking year. Yep. Then we go to the broker and get it. Can you set up another split for $50,000 that's deductible yep. that we keep investing? Now,
yeah, there's a few traps for young players in
there. There is. And then what I want to get to, Vince, is the actual asset that we invest in.
Yes.
So some of the traps.
Well, the traps are around structuring it. So it's very important that the new borrowing is very clearly drawn to invest. So you want to make sure that the money goes directly from your home loan into your brokerage account, and do not pass this through your offset account. Yep. Do not pass this through your checking account. Do not mix it with other money. It must go straight from your home loan to your investment account.
And there's the traps there. It's like, well, we've got a joint investment account and the home loan's just in my spouse's name or something like that. Can get muddy.
It can. I mean, what matters is where the money was invested. Yep. So quite often we see people with joint home loan accounts and the investment then is in one of their names. And depending on the nature of the investment, that might be the higher rate taxpayer to get a bigger deduction on the interest. Mm. Which is usually the debt recycling piece, or the lower tax rate payer for the gearing strategy. And so looking at your tax position is a pretty critical part of that analysis. So it doesn't matter whose name the loan is in between a couple. Mm. What matters is what's it invested in, and whoever owns that asset is the person who claims the tax deduction.
Mm. And the claims the taxable income of the distributions.
And earns the taxable income. So yeah. there's a bit of modelling to be done to work out whose name to do it in.
I've been vocal on this, and we will get to the assets to invest in, but I've been vocal on this probably from my own experience when, you know, a million years ago when I was actually dealing with clients. These type of strategies, like, and I think about the ramp, right? So we leave school, maybe go to university or get into the workforce, build our career. We're coming into our 30s. We ramp up. We might buy the house. We might start a family. And obviously this is for everyone because I'm knocking on 40's door and I don't have a family. while you're on that ramp, these strategies seldom work because you throw kids into the mix. You're going to have some cash flow issues. Yeah. You drop one income, you might have some cash flow issues. So I've seen this work really good for those who have, like, might be in the house that's big enough for the next 10 years, mm-hmm. who have kids in primary school. And if there's a couple, they're both back at work. Yeah. So we've got some longer term stability. We've got a 15-year runway without any possible whoopsies.
Yeah. So you do need to plan ahead. And this is one of those reasons where having an ongoing relationship with an advisor is really important. You know, many people think that, oh, all I need is some help to get going. And
we've actually got a question on that, Vince.
Oh, okay, but we can come back and talk to that later. But,
yep.
you know, there are so many little paperwork tricks and traps that need to be worked through. None of them are individually rocket science, but the thing is to keep on top of them and to deal with those changes in lifestyle. So, you know, if you've got a couple, stay-at-home partner and high-earning partner, you might be better off investing in the name of the stay-at-home partner rather than debt recycling.
Yeah, so to get that first 18.5 or 18.2 tax-free threshold.
Yeah. So there's more to it than meets the eye, and if some is good, more isn't always better.
And that's my problem. I always think I want more because some is good. Remember Jerry Seinfeld's joke with the medication? I want you to work out what will kill me and back it off just a little bit.
Just dial it down to 9.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's talk about assets that we invest in. Mm-hmm. Now, we'll use me as an example. I've got a lot of equity in my portfolio, my property portfolio with mortgages. I'm in the process of doing they call it a cash out. Mm-hmm. So we cash out the equity to invest. I'm going to be investing into some shares at some point. So gearing into shares because it's not debt recycling because I've got no non-deductible debt. But what are some of the traps there when people might go, well, I'll withdraw it, I'll do the cash out, plonk it here for 6 months?
Yeah, there are two big traps I think that people fall into on that. The first one is mixing it with other money. So you need to be able to identify this money as clearly being the money that's invested. So if you, let's say you have $5,000 in your deposit account, you take your $100,000 from your redraw and stick it in your deposit account and then withdraw $100,000 and invest it. Well, now only 100/150 of that interest is deductible because you've polluted it with this other money.
Mm.
So that's probably mistake number one. And then mistake number two is to draw the money from your new split and deposit it in an offset account.
Even if that offset account is linked to that split mortgage.
And it doesn't matter while it's still in that offset account, but the question is, well, what did you borrow this money for? If you borrowed the money and placed it in an offset account, A, it's not generating income, so the money wasn't borrowed for income-producing purposes.
Yep.
Because an offset account is just a deposit account that doesn't earn interest, and there's a gentleman's agreement with the bank to offset the balance in that account against your home loan to charge you less interest. But the money placed from the loan into the deposit account, not generating income earning, and then when you withdraw it, you've sort of broken that nexus. So that is one I see quite a lot. And certainly a lot of the Facebook groups, I see this talked about a lot.
So you really need to tell your mortgage broker, hey, when you do the cash out, I want you to deposit this money into this account in BSB, and that account in BSB is an interest-bearing account on your brokerage or Macquarie CMA or your Superhero cash account.
Yeah. So if you're with CompSec, the CDIA account that goes with it pays interest, and it's clearly part of your brokerage account. If you do need to park money for a while, perhaps look at buying a cash ETF like a AAA or AAA. You're going to lose money because you're paying 6% interest and earning 4 and a bit, but at least you preserve the borrowing. Better yet, not draw the money.
Mm.
And just draw it when you're ready to go.
I wonder if they would do that. Would they set it up?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll have to check with my broker. Because as I said, like for me, I'm just getting that cash out to have powder dry and to really work out what I want to do. But if we go to the investment amount, so if I want to borrow to invest, I believe personally, all day long, you need to be able to support that repayment with your employment income or at least have buffers, because if you're borrowing to invest to buy an investment property, there could be time where there's no tenants.
That's right. You've got to – I mean, this is where your emergency stash
and
a steady income really comes in. Borrowing to invest is a strategy for people with stable incomes.
Yeah.
You don't want to ever have to sell because you need to pay the interest.
Yeah.
Because the – odds of you having to do that are probably because you've lost your job and there's a decline in the economy and therefore the stock market's down.
Mm.
So
it's the worst time to sell.
Yeah. And similarly with a margin loan, when you get margin called, it's probably because your assets have fallen in value and you're going to be selling at a low point. So the ability to stay the course is critical, which is possibly a good reason not to borrow 100%. So with a diversified portfolio, probably getting 5% yields and some franking. So that's pretty close to paying for a loan at 6.25% today.
And that's the thing, because I could get my borrowed money, put it into some specky share that doesn't pay dividends.
Yeah. And now you've got to find, well, where am I going to find a 6%?
Yes. Now that is deductible, yes, but it's a cash flow thing because my quote-unquote gearing strategy is to invest into this thing that's going to the moon and it's not paying dividends, but I know it's going to go to the moon and in 3 years' time I'm going to sell it and quadruple my money.
Yeah. And of course you do need an expectation of having dividends at some point.
Yes.
So if you go and buy Berkshire Hathaway, which doesn't pay dividends, that interest is probably not deductible.
Mm.
So if you're buying a specky mining stock that has a plan to open the mine in a year's time and start paying dividends, that's probably okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, buying a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't pay dividends is likely to be not deductible. And the logic behind that is a capital gain is not ordinary income.
Mm.
Gets taxed like it's ordinary income after you divide it by two. But from a legal perspective, they're different. And so the has to be some nexus between income.
Producing income.
And
that's the thing, like it's the same where people buy a block of land that they're going to build an investment property on. That's cute that you're going to do that in the future.
But not tax deductible.
But it's not tax deductible now because it's not producing income.
That's right. It does get added into your cost base. So yes. You eventually get it back, but it doesn't create the same effect as a negative geared property.
Yeah. So, but most people most of the time would mostly use some type of portfolio or parcel of shares that would produce a dividend at or distribution at least half a year.
Yeah.
Half yearly.
Yeah.
So if you're doing this, you need to be able to cash flow the first 6 months of interest repayments on that loan. Can you do that? Well, that's what you've got to work out.
Yep. Well, you might have to give up your Wagyu and Shiraz for 6 months.
Before we go to a break, do you think there is a potential, I don't know, need or when you do these gearing strategies, because you do want to produce income, like do you just buy the four banks?
Well, the four banks, apart from CBA, have underperformed the S&P 200 or SX 200 for most of the last 15 years. So buying banks...
What, like the accumulation index?
Yep.
Yeah, right.
So CBA and Macquarie are the only two Australian banks that have outperformed the index.
Okay, you just buy CBA?
Yeah. But you, I mean, it's a good point that you raise. And historically, you know, if you go back 20 years ago, it would have been quite common for people to gear into a portfolio of banks.
Mm.
But I think that just highlights the difficulty of stock picking. So you would have done better if you'd simply bought the ASX 200 or 300. I mean, if you'd been lucky to pick Macquarie, you probably would have won. But, you know.
But what's the do you know off the top of your head what the yield of the ASX 200 is at the moment? Is it like
four and a half? 4 or 5, yeah. I mean, it sort of hovers around that most of the time.
So you're still going to need to plug the hole.
Plus franking, of course.
But you're still going to need to plug the hole year on year.
Yeah, there will be a slight shortfall.
Mm.
When you get your tax refund at the end of the day, you'll probably end up pretty close to break even, especially if you get a couple of unusual dividends. So the year Westfield left the index, massive distribution.
Yeah, there was.
So it's hard to predict, but generally it's in that sort of 4 to 5 range.
What about just dumping your geared money into VAP?
Well, that's an interesting one. Mm. Don't try this at home, folks. But the interesting thing about...
that's what I'm thinking of doing.
Now, I do have a license to give financial advice, but this is not personal advice, and this is not a recommendation. But the investing in real estate or REITs, real estate investment trusts, which is what VAP, Vanguard Australian Property ETF, invests in, pay a very special type of distribution. And a fair chunk of your distribution is tax deferred. Now, what that means is that the fund, underlying funds have claimed depreciation, so their cash earnings are higher than their taxable earnings, and they will generally give out all of the cash. So some of the money you receive is not taxable, and so after tax, that can start looking pretty good. Generally don't come with franked dividends, though, so there is a trade-off here. But the downside is that distribution reduces your cost base. So when you come to sell, and of course you hold forever, don't you?
I bloody hope I do.
Funny how everyone always says that. Yeah. But when you come to sell, you're going to pay some of it back as capital gains. Admittedly, you're going to pay it back at half the rate that you got it in the first place. And it could be years or decades away.
Mm.
So, but of course, we should never let the tax tail wag the investment dog. And choosing to invest in real estate investment trust purely because of the tax deferral is
well, I'm not doing it because of the tax deferral.
But that, yeah, it's right now, you know, listed real estate is probably trading below what the real value of the underlying assets are.
Yeah, there's still a bit of a recovery from COVID. And I mean, it's almost, I reckon it's almost back.
Yeah. I mean, I still think there's a, it's difficult to be absolute because there's so few physical transactions in underlying business buildings. Mm. But there's a fair argument, I think, that the listed real estate market is overshot.
Mm.
And that's probably a really good reason not to be investing in a super fund, which is knee-deep in unlisted property, because those valuations haven't come off as quickly. So that's a reason to invest and to not invest.
Mm, there you go, children. Rates. We'll be back right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, we are back. It is the community segment of the week brought to you by Sky Wealth. Hey, if you need to get your insurances sorted, you need to reach out to Sky Wealth. Sky.com.au. They'll have a 15-minute complimentary chat, because any of this borrowing, gearing and all that, if you do not have your income protection sorted first, stop. Because if your money stops, you're screwed, basically. So reach out to Sky Wealth and they'll have a 15-minute chat. Sky.com.au. We asked you in the Facebook group, what have you quit or said no to in order to head where you want to go? Maddie said, keeping up with the Joneses. Who gives an F about clothing brands? 79 jewel cabs and dream homes. Crap cars, Kmart boardies and no debt. That is living, Barry. I mean,
living the dream.
I personally, I don't know. I don't actually care what people do, but I like to buy quality clothes. And I've just found, for example, potentially some Kmart brand things aren't as nice fitting as other brands. So
yeah, and I think the
but it's your what's your trade off? What's your thing that you're happy to trade off?
I'm a very reluctant shopper. Mm. So when I do go shopping, I need it to be made very easy for me. So I'm probably not the ideal. I do live a relatively frugal lifestyle with some extravagances. Mm. Like I do like a car with a three-pointed star on the front. I do travel business class when I travel overseas. I do not travel to Melbourne business class. But apart from those extravagances, I live a relatively low-key, frugal life. But I think the important point is, you know, is trading down in your wardrobe going to make you feel better having the portfolio to offset it?
Mm.
Or is having the right clothes more important to you? This is why values-based spending is so important.
Mm.
And if you, I mean, I wrote a whole book about this, but if you try giving up your morning latte in order to pay for your house, that's a really tough trade-off to keep up. That's making 365 decisions when spending $25,000 less on your house would pay for a lifetime of lattes.
Mm.
So this is about doing what matters to you. And if you don't value quality coffee or quality clothes, then don't buy them.
Don't do it, yeah. Jane said, not waiting my turn at a workplace for a promotion by setting my goals and applying for opportunities elsewhere. So that's right. The only one who cares about your career more than you is the person in the mirror. Like, only you care about your career as much as you do.
That's right.
But no one else does.
But you do have to be aware that what the next employer is going to think.
Mm.
So if you're jumping ship every 6 months, don't be surprised when you don't get the next job.
That's right. Celeste, buying new clothes or makeup or hair products. I use what I have first. Daniel Quinn, my last job where I wanted to go hasn't materialized in a couple of years and where I had definitely an idea of getting there. I don't know if I read that right or if he wrote it right, whatever. Paul said, alcohol, the negatives started to outweigh the positives, so it became a no-brainer for me to give it up.
Yeah, now that's a perfect example of alignment of savings and values.
Yeah. Lisa, retail shopping, only marketplace, thrift stores or secondhand for me. And I will say, like, when I moved into my new apartment, the dining room setting, marketplace, there is just so much, because it gets to the point where it's not about the money. Like, yeah, I could walk into freaking any of those stores free and I'll have that. But it's just so ridiculous and you can get such a good deal secondhand with bulky stuff if you're patient and willing to put that time and effort in.
And willing to get mugged when you go to pick it up.
Exactly. So there you go, everyone. We'll bounce out of the community segment of the week right into some housekeeping. Hey, we just want to talk about two new podcasts that we've got happening, Financially Fierce. It's hosted by Jessa Brady. She's a financial advisor and she wants to empower you to be more in control of your money and build the financial future you want. That drops on a Monday, everyone. So shape your money mindset, learn how to invest, curb your bad spending habits and become financially fierce. So do yourself a favor, subscribe to Financially Fierce. If you want to send a podcast to a friend or family member that isn't this one, because I'm a bit abrupt or brash or abrasive or insert your word here that describes me.
I think lovable is the word.
Lovable. Send them Financially Fierce. The second podcast that we've got that's happening now is Retire Right. If you've got parents that are over 55, don't tell them what to do with their money. Let us tell them. That's why we've started Retire Right. It is for anyone over age 50, 55 who wants to start looking at the next 10 or 15 years, how to optimize their money and really dig into that retirement. And it's also for people over 60 who have retired. So, yeah, just really for that type of market. So like the people that you hang around, Vince.
Yep.
So there you go.
Sydney boomers.
Exactly. So subscribe to Retire Right. Send it to your mum and your dad and your uncles and aunts and your grandparents. And Financially Fierce because, yeah, it is such a good show that Jess has happening there. Now, we'll get back into the show. Vince, we talked about getting started, the debt recycling and more advanced stuff. I talked to a guy in, I think it was Melbourne, and it was around this property thing, like, oh, I've got a good income, want to buy a property, I just can't find the right thing or how to get started. And I said, what do you do for work? He said, I'm an engineer. I'm like, interesting. Now, you are a former recovering engineer.
I do. I have a degree in engineering.
Yes. So
I've never practiced, but I do have a degree.
Yeah, interesting. So there is a certain personality with engineers and we need our
school teachers.
Like, we need engineers to be pretty perfect when they design a bridge. We need them to be pretty spot on when designing a car door. Like, it has to work. It has to be forward planned, no variables. We know this is it's a yes, no, this can happen or not. Like, that is an engineer. Now, Vince, the problem sometimes And I don't know if it is analysis paralysis. I think it is more that because I'm wired this way, I actually find it needs to be perfect and I need to know an outcome before I commit to it, which leads to a delay in start, which leads to, it's been 2 years and we still haven't invested.
Yeah, I mean, there are largely two types of personalities. There are those who need lots of information to make a decision, and there are those who are comfortable making decisions with half the information. Neither one of those is perfect. And people who are attracted to the teaching profession or the engineering profession, and to a slightly lesser extent, software engineering. It wasn't called software engineering when I studied, but anyway. And they tend to need lots of information to make a decision. So if you've ever done a Myers-Briggs, anyone who got an N in that second INTP or ISTJ, whatever it was, the second one is a measure of how much information you need to make a decision. And engineers and teachers generally need lots of information. And when you get a couple, of which there are a lot, where you have a school teacher married to an engineer, this is a recipe for lack of action. And, of course, nobody ever starved to death because they couldn't read a nutrition label. So getting going or messy action, I can't remember whose book that was, but there is a lot to be said for getting going. Now, some of the decisions we're talking about here are very large decisions, like should I buy a house, should I buy investment property, should I borrow money to invest? These are potentially life-changing decisions. So it is important to get them right, and having the right advice, you know, having someone else involved in the decision can often help to break that deadlock. But, you know, sometimes done is better than perfect. And just on that, we use a money personality test at Life Sherpa, and there is a very strong correlation between jobs and personality. And two of them, the producer and the achiever, both have firm beliefs that success is a function of their hard work, which means they tend to...
So that would be a...
So teachers, engineers need lots of information, believe in that luck plays little part in.
So that's a growth mindset.
It is to an extent, but it also leads to recrimination when the market falls. They're likely to blame themselves when the market falls,
right?
Rather than going, well, actually, that was the market. And so helping them make the decision and breaking down the decision into fairly simple binaries is extremely useful.
So if we take old mate who wanted to buy an investment property, for example, are we saying you're worried, you can't make a decision because it's so funny. A lot of the time it's like, I can't make a decision because all the what ifs of it going negatives, and what if the bad happens, but what if the good stuff happens?
Yeah. I mean, it is important to be aware of the what ifs could go wrong and to plan what you would do if they did happen, to prepare for how you would deal with it. But they're usually not reasons to not do it. And particularly when it comes to investing, the whole point about investing is it's taking risk to make a return, whether that's a real estate or it's buying a home or it's investing in shares. All of these come with risks. And the key thing to work out is this a risk, or is the reward that's potentially coming from this risk worth it to me, and how would I deal with those downsides? So if you buy a piece of property and it's not the perfect, but that the suburb next door grows faster in the first few years, but you're still making 5% growth, is that a bad thing? Sure, it would have been better buying in the next suburb, but you're never going to know that in advance. So just as you can't pick stocks, it's pretty hard to pick suburbs.
So in that scenario, if someone needs all the information, they can't act, do we get as simple as, well, you need to actually write down all the reasons stopping you from acting and like list them out. Well, I'm not sure if I want to do this property because what if the tenant sucks and doesn't pay? Okay, first line, we get insurance, landlord insurance, number one. Number two, we have cash reserve. Number three, we get a good agent that can really screen these people. And maybe you say, I only want a tenant who's had a solid 3 years track record. And I'm sorry, but the first time home leaver, I can't accommodate.
Yeah. And that might mean the trade-off is you have a week or two's more vacancies.
Yes.
And these are trade-offs that are perfectly reasonable things to do.
Yeah.
And that's why we don't predict, we prepare, plan and protect as appropriate. So if you take that example, you make a very good point. If I'm investing in real estate, I've got a lot of upfront expenses. I'm going to generally earn less income than my borrowing cost. That's called negative gearing. And I am relying on a tenant paying the bills and not trashing my joint. Mm. And I'm relying on the property rising in value over time. If you're not prepared to take those risks, you probably shouldn't be investing in real estate. Notwithstanding that, you know, real estate's an important part of any balanced portfolio. And so you go, well, if I'm struggling with taking these risks, how can I mitigate them? So landlord's insurance, good agent, picking the right area.
Emergency funds.
Having an emergency fund.
Ideal tenant profile.
Maybe fixing your interest rate. There's a whole bunch of protective things that you can do, which may or may not increase your overall return. They may decrease.
And this is the thing, like, if you are that type of personality who needs 100% certainty on stuff before you act, you're never going to get it.
Yeah.
Unless you buy a term deposit.
Which is still guaranteeing you're going to go backwards in inflation terms.
Exactly.
So,
but at least you, like,
you know,
but you know it's going backwards,
yes,
and at least I know I'm getting a fixed return.
That's right. So you cannot have growth without risk.
Mm.
And the question is, what is the growth that I'm comfortable with? And if I'm not prepared to take that risk, I have to save more. And am I prepared to spend less so I can save more or earn more so I can save more?
And on the investment property thing, I'd probably ask the person who might be like, oh, I really do want to buy an investment property, but I know I've got to borrow for it and I've got to do all this. Would you still want to buy an investment property if you had $500,000 cash rock up in your account today? Like, is it the borrowing that's causing the stress or is it the asset itself?
Yeah. And having the right people around you will help you make these decisions because a good one should test your assumptions and test your prejudices and beliefs. Some of them are perfectly valid. Some of them are very true. And, you know, borrowing $500,000 to buy a $700,000 property is a big step. That's a lot of debt, especially if you're making $100,000 a year. So this is not something to fall into lightly. It is a long-term decision and your return is fundamentally driven by future capital growth.
Mm.
You can stack the odds in your favour, you know, by buying in the right area. You know, middle ring, so I'm sure John will argue with me on this one, but you know, middle ring suburbs, owner-occupier territory will always rent well. They may not have the highest yield today, but you know, how much vacancy do you need on a higher yield property to lower the yield? So it is about stacking the deck in your favour and making sure that you're comfortable with those risks and having the right professional guide you through that decision.
There you have it. We'll finish with a question from Mark. Seeking opinions. After 2 years' work with a good financial planner, my wife and I have everything nicely set up for our life stage. Insurances, super contributions, emergency funds, investments outside of super, strong knowledge and financial literacy, healthy projections and all that stuff. The next 6 years will be pretty boring financially until our youngest finishes high school. But after that, there are some more meaningful and complex options opening up to us where a financial planner's advice seems worth the price. Question, is it worth continuing to pay approximately $4,000 a year for quote-unquote full-service financial advice during this upcoming six-year period? As best I can determine, it's steady as she goes, accumulation, paying down debt, maximizing super, etc. Thanks all. So do we go to an advisor, get set up, and then go, thank you, next?
That's a difficult act to pull off. financial planning is not an event, it's a process. So the concept that you can go and do it once and never have to think about it again just makes zero sense. Mm. So an ongoing relationship is, to my mind, critical to keeping this on track. Now, this is not a comment on the your specific advisor or the price you're being charged, but as a general guide that if you need help to get set up, you need help to keep it on track, because just as you think it's set up right, something will change. The government will change a rule, your family circumstance will change, your parents might die, you might get posted overseas. There's all sorts of things can happen day to day. And the challenge is knowing when those changes in circumstances should lead you to revisit the plan. So it's the Donald Rumsfeld unknown unknowns that the having a steady relationship with somebody that you're comfortable working with is important to keeping things on track.
It's likely akin to that. Well, I've done Pilates for the last 12 months. I go weekly. It's awesome. I know how to do it. I'm just going to do it at home now and expect the same results. And it might be a unique individual that has the discipline to do it at home, has the drive to do it at home. My question is, and this is for a personality like me, I actually need that accountability there to keep me on track with doing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you'll find that most financial advisors use a financial advisor, that it's as much behavior management and keeping an eye on what's potentially changing, both for you, for the things you're invested in, and the environment generally, that, the keeping stuff on track. It might be less work than the initial setup. There's a lot of work in getting set up, getting insurance in place, getting the portfolio set up, getting the tax structures in place. But keeping it on track is, still a vital part of that exercise. And most people, life gets in the way. And, particularly if you've got kids, it's really hard to focus on this sort of stuff and to spend enough time to go, well, actually, does that article on page 23 of the newspaper affect me? And does this change in the law affect me? What does this change to thresholds mean?
I mean, we don't know this person's income.
No.
But I would say you've got to ask yourself, like, if this person's household income was $200,000, is it worth 2% per year to have this?
You would think that it would be. I mean, all of the research, if you look at the Vanguard research and the Russell research, and Vanguard probably have a vested interest in persuading people not to use advisors, whereas Russell probably have the opposite analysis. And they both broadly come to the same conclusion, as do no end of academic studies, that having an advisor is worth about 3% a year to most people. Mm. Now, that's not to say that your investment in the Vanguard Australian Share Fund is going to do 3% better. Because the return comes from the market. The job of your advisor is to make sure that that return ends up in your pocket and that you don't pay unnecessary taxes, that you don't take unnecessary risks, and you get rewarded for the risks you are taking. And that's a pretty tough gig to do on your own.
This is a long bow to draw, but I'm good at drawing long bows. You know, when the coalition of the willing invaded Iraq after 9/11, we were there for one purpose, to get old mate, right? Now, a little thing crept in. Well, it's called mission creep, basically. Mm-hmm. Like 20 years down the track, we're bloody in a different country doing a different thing, doing nation building, because we just – so I think what I'm getting at is the lifestyle creep in your life, it doesn't happen over 6 to 12 months.
It doesn't happen overnight, but it will happen.
Yes. So will that – I'll just say your 2% that you're paying your advisor each year – keep you to the mission of what you're doing. Mm. But if it wasn't there, in 2.5 years' time, can you guarantee you just didn't turn my super down a little bit because we want to spend a little bit more over here.
And yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure it's not 2%. I'm sure it's a lot less than that.
Yes.
But, and that's why I said I just not comment on your specific advisor or your specific fee deal. But as a general rule, most investors underperform the funds they invest in. And if you look at the $14 billion in wealth destroyed by people investing, largely unadvised people investing in Cathie Wood's ARC funds, that the discipline of a professional, the right professional, I'm not saying all are good, but the right professional that looks after people like you will be worth every cent of it.
Mm. So, and then also lean in as well. Don't just go, all right, I'll keep paying and you know, be active and go, yeah, we're going to meet the twice a year and this is annoying. I hate going to my hygienist twice a year to get my teeth done, but I lean in. I pay for it because I know I get results.
Yeah. And if you think about $4,000 is probably 12 hours work.
Yeah.
That's an hour a month.
Yeah.
So.
Use it.
Yeah. And, you know, depending on how complex your affairs are, an hour a month doesn't actually go very far. You know, if you've got quarterly rebalancing, you've got annual review, you've got.
I saw this on Facebook. Is it relevant to me?
Yep.
No.
So, you know, when you break that down by the hour, that's not a lot of money. Now, if your total wealth is $200,000, $4,000 might seem a bit steep, but conceptually, that's not an unreasonable number if you've got enough money.
Mm. There you have it. Well, we might leave it there. Thank you so much for listening today. Vince, we'll have you on, I think, very soon for a campfire chat.
Oh, I better go and get some more s'mores.
Yeah. Thanks, friends. And remember, if you have a friend or a family member that could be interested in the stuff we've talked about, the gearing, the ETFs, the not taking action in this uncertain world, I would really appreciate it if you did forward this to a friend. If you're not subscribed and you just dropped in to have a listen to this one, please hit subscribe and give us a go for a couple of weeks and see if you can be encouraged. But we appreciate you spending the time listening today. My name's Glenn James. This guy is
Vince Scully.
And this was Money. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have three books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.